Let me start by saying that I've entitled this talk tonight, Engaged Buddhism and the Role of Individual Spirituality in Working for Peace and Justice. And I don't know how much time afterwards I really want to respect the need to end at 9 o'clock. I know people are busy and probably have a lot going on, but I will make a commitment to stay around for those of you that have questions if we don't get an opportunity for questions and answers with the time. So since I was a very little young girl, I have had a passion for justice. For those of you that came in late, as La said, I was a social worker and community organizer before I worked in the criminal justice system, first as a cop for 20 years, then as the head of probation and parole for the state of Wisconsin Department of Corrections, and then as an assistant attorney general in the Department of Justice. So my background's a little odd. I attended my first retreat with my teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, or Thai as we call him, in 1991, and it was my recovery from alcoholism that really created the yearning that led me to that initial retreat, which planted the seeds of mindfulness for me, and it's a spiritual transformation that continues to this day. I was attracted to Buddhism because it was a framework that encouraged me to make my own spiritual decisions based on my own experiences. And it was Thay's simplicity, his non-intellectual approach, and his push for social action and engaged Buddhism that attracted me to his tradition. And early in 2008, he honored me by ordaining me as a Dharma teacher. Initially, I began working for social justice as a very angry rebel. It's embarrassing, really, to think about it. Fighting for equality, but really I was vacillating back and forth between inferiority, superiority, and equality complexes. Growing up in a very poor, lower working class family with two alcoholic parents produced a sense of unconscious rage in me that I really wasn't sure as a young person how to deal with. And there's a lot of energy behind anger. In fact, sometimes that's what attracts people to it. So fighting for social justice in various forms was one of the fuels that I used to keep my own anger alive and to keep it burning. And although I certainly was a part of bringing about some changes in a number of systems, because I did it from a place with a chip on my shoulder, I also created a lot of harm. And it was my unconscious sense of victimization that led me to some very unskillful behaviors in my personal and my work relationships. So for me, this path of mindfulness continues to be about not only learning how to live in the present moment and accept life as it is, to wake up to the mystery of what's right here and now. But with time, I get reassuring and increasingly frequent glimpses of my own vastness and my interconnection with everybody and everything in the universe. And this path has enabled me to experience the divinity of life, its holiness, and its birthless, and its deathless nature. Now, I was such an unlikely candidate for this path that I consider finding my way here, nothing short of a miracle. And, you know, I could spend some time telling you the story of my own transformation, but that's relatively boring. So I thought I'd share 7 reflections from my own practice and in my particularly with respect to my work with others for social justice. First, I have internalized the 4 noble truths, and I can sum them up in one sentence. The crap in your life is the compost of your enlightenment. Sogyal Rinpoche says that hell is not punishment, it's training. And this simply means that if we can work effectively with the things that condemn us, they will free us. There's nothing redemptive or healing about the suffering itself. Transformation is certainly not found in the pain, but in our relationship to it and the openings we cultivate in the face of it. So our practice is to be able to identify our suffering, to be with it, to look deeply at it, to take good care of it, and to learn another way to relate to it. And when we learn how to frame and understand our own suffering, then we develop the compassion for ourselves and for others that allows us to accept our own fractured beings and understand the holiness of our imperfections. And then we're able to help others frame their own suffering. You know, over and over and over, life just keeps coming at us, and it is what it is. In the last year of my own life, my partner's beloved mother died. My partner was turned down for disability after having to leave her job because of a chronic illness. My stepson needed a kidney transplant. One of my own sons had a drug-induced psychotic break. Our car started on fire. I was a victim of identity theft for about $42,000. And then I broke my arm badly enough to require plates and pins the last week of May, a week before Sharon Salzberg and I were co-leading a retreat for over 200 people. You know, the events in our lives that trigger our reactions are not the cause of our suffering. The suffering, or dukkha, as we call it in Buddhism, is caused by our reaction to those events, not the events themselves. If we begin to assume that we did something wrong to cause the kinds of events that I just mentioned, or are to blame for them, or they occurred because we're being punished for in some way for not being a good enough person, a good enough parent, a good enough partner, then we're simply adding a second and unnecessary layer of dukkha or suffering to those events that is just not necessary. That's just your ego talking. Whenever your ego says, it's your fault, that's what the Buddha was talking about when he said Mara was talking to him. Meditation and mindfulness practice are tools we can use to stop adding that unnecessary layer of suffering to the events that occur in our life. The events themselves are not important. No matter how much we want it to be otherwise, the truth is that we are not in control, and we don't get to choose the form of crap that will be the compost for our enlightenment. You know, maybe you preferred pig shit and you got cow shit. I don't know. You know? But what's important is what our mind does with those events and how we work with them to weave them into a tapestry of acceptance and practice opportunities. Our path is simply what it is. And it makes no difference whether the events that occur on that path are random or divine intervention. So there's no sense in arguing about it either. The Indian teacher, Krishnamurti, after years, turned to his audience and he said, "Do you want to know my secret?" And there were people who had been coming to see him for years, and they had failed to grasp what they thought was the essence of his teaching. So they were very excited. At last, the great master is going to give us the key to understanding. And he looked at them and he said, "I don't mind what happens. I don't mind what happens." In other words, the secret is to always be able to accept the present moment as if you had chosen it. Then anything that occurs is simply part of the beautiful tapestry of your own life that you're weaving together, and you can use anything that happens to learn more about what it means to be human and to discover your own Buddha nature at the same time as you're learning more about what it means to be human. Second, I've learned that there are multiple Dharma doors. The truth is many-sided. There isn't any truth with a capital T. It can be approached from multiple perspectives, and that it's important to develop a deep sense of openness. Now, the kind of openness that I am talking about isn't simply being open to the viewpoints of others. It requires a commitment to exploring mystery and paradox and beginning to understand non-duality and finding the middle way between things like fear and faith, self-acceptance and self-indulgence, between inertia and compulsion, between doing the right thing and righteousness, between gentle and fierce compassion, and between viewing ourselves as either victims or oppressors. To me, any door that helps people lead an ethical and compassionate life is a legitimate Dharma door. And as a student of the Dharma, my own challenge is to discover the Dharma doors that work best for me. And for me, that's been, from a Buddhist perspective, a very creative blend of the Vipassana tradition with my own root Zen tradition. But from a continual adult learner perspective, it has been a very eclectic tool bag of pieces of many other things that I have found very, very helpful. And that I've also been able to take pieces of if the whole thing doesn't make sense to me and leave the rest behind. As a Dharma teacher, my challenge is twofold. First, to find and invite people through the Dharma doors that they can relate to by translating the Dharma into a language they can understand. In this respect, we're all Dharma teachers. We all take the Dharma everywhere because we all come from and have unique arenas that we participate in. Whether we are stay-at-home caretakers or paid employees, we all have the wisdom and knowledge that comes from having made the relationships we have and meeting the people that we've met and forming the networks that we have and working in the places that we are part of. For me, I have a special affiliation with the criminal justice system because I understand the language and the culture of that system and how to translate the language so people will understand it. And we can all do that. My second challenge as a Dharma teacher is to encourage people and to invite people to take responsibility for their own learning, to trust themselves enough to question and investigate what they're being told, to trust their own experience and find the unique doors that work for them. When we don't take responsibility for our own understanding, it's then that we get caught in the shadow side of surrender and devotion. Having faith in our own Buddha nature is the knowledge that nobody can tell us anything that we already don't deeply know. And it's up to us to uncover it. It's up to us to pull back the veils of illusion. People can inspire that in us, but nobody can transmit it to us. Blind loyalty or blind devotion, whether it's to a teacher, a boss, or a politician, makes our relationship with them passive and dependent. And then we're going to inevitably be disappointed and angry because their human imperfections eventually will knock them off the pedestals that we've placed them on. However, although skillful doubting is part, and it's an important skill, for any student of the Dharma, it shouldn't be confused with cynicism, self-righteousness, or engaging others in pointless debate. Like other Buddhist teachings, many of Thay's teachings focus on our interdependence and interconnection with everybody and everything. In fact, the name of his order is the Order of Interbeing. An especially important part of these teachings is that if we truly understand our interconnection with others, we can all find ways that we've been both victimized and oppressed. And when we don't deny this, and we make friends with both the internal victim and the oppressor, then we begin to understand the ways that over-identification with one or the other is an obstacle to our practice. That doesn't mean that justice, or rather injustice, doesn't take place, and that we have to accept injustice. We do have ethical obligations to prevent the exploitation of others. But it does mean that in our practice, we need to understand dichotomies, and that over-identification with the victim role can lead to a very dangerous sense of entitlement that can be just as destructive as the oppressor's abuse of power. And I've seen this happen over and over and over. The employees that I've worked with in one arena or another, they didn't get that position that they knew they deserved, or they didn't get that promotion that they wanted. So the first thing that happens is, okay, I'll put in my 8 hours, but you're not getting another thing out of me. And then it's, okay, well, you know, I think I'm going to go work out for an hour and a half, and then I'll do that shopping that needs to get done on my way back. And in COPS, I've seen it take the form of, I put my life on the line every day, so I deserve that free cup of coffee, which leads to that free meal, which leads to that free dry cleaning, which leads to that free hour. Whatever. And how many of us, with very good intentions, unknowingly create this sense of entitlement in our own children. So an understanding of non-duality leads to the simple understanding that this is because that is. Democrats can't exist without Republicans. It's that simple. Progressives can't exist without conservatives. And when we really begin to understand causes and conditions, we begin to develop deeper insights. For example, I talked about complexes. Deeper insights about all of this lead to understanding that inferiority and superiority and equality complexes are just a result of our illusions of separation. They're no longer necessary. If we don't see ourselves, or when they're no longer necessary, when we see ourselves in the ultimate dimension. Third, I've learned that it's impossible to end violence with violence. And this has been a very interesting lesson, given that I was a police officer for 20 years. Working for peace and justice requires an unwavering personal commitment to nonviolence in our own lives and in the environments and systems that we are part of. And the first and most important way that any of us can eliminate violence is by skillfully not contributing to any form of aggression in ourselves, in our actions, and in our speech. It's taken me a long time to internalize this one. If I could remember everybody that I need to make amends to, as a result of my self-righteous arrogance in my younger days, I'd still be making them. I was one of those peace activists during the Vietnam War who was incapable of making peace in my own heart, and in my family, and with the people that I worked with. You know, and then I had other experiences that made this lesson a lot deeper for me. I was really happy when, as a young police officer, one of the very first demonstrations that I had to work was an anti-apartheid demonstration. It was really great to be protecting the right to assemble and freedom of speech for people, demonstrating for a cause that I myself felt so deeply about. And so I'm walking through the crowd and saying hi to people, and all of a sudden this guy comes up to me and he spits on me. And he's like, come on, pig, you know you want to hit me. You know you want to hit me. You know you want to arrest me. And he just kept baiting me. And boy, did I want to hit him. really kept baiting me. So he couldn't get past the uniform to see a potential ally because it didn't come in the form he expected it. And how is this kind of righteousness in a leftist activist any different than that of a conservative Christian fundamentalist? I see people all the time contributing to interpersonal, familial, and systemic dysfunction because they falsely believe if they can punish the person or persons they mistakenly see as responsible for their anger or victimization that they're going to suffer less. But people bent on punishing each other simply escalate each other's suffering. In fact, our criminal justice system is based on the premise that punishment of the perpetrator is going to heal the victim and rehabilitate the perpetrator. So when victims of crime get focused on vengeance and punishment, and I've seen that happen over and over, I have never seen it make them feel better or heal them in any way. If they're focused on vengeance, even when the wrongdoer or the perpetrator does repent, it doesn't create either forgiveness or healing in them. However, I cannot tell you how many times that I've seen the victim's forgiveness create very sincere repentance in the wrongdoer. I've seen some incredible things happen in this realm. One of the more nasty crimes that I attended and was a part of the prosecution was of a young man who had called an escort to his room and had not only killed her, but had lopped off her breast, had carved up her legs, and had stuffed a knife up her vagina. And that was the scene that I walked into. I will never forget the moment in the courtroom when after the perpetrator's mother was sentenced, that I watched the victim's mother and the perpetrator's mother sob in each other's arms. That is the beginning of healing and forgiveness. Fourth, the litmus test of spirituality is relationship, which includes building community, building sangha, both inside and outside of our practice communities. Spirituality, for some people, can be yet one more way of becoming preoccupied with ourselves. And while spirituality can be discovered in solitude, it can only be fulfilled in relationship and community. I don't know about you, but I found it fairly easy to be spiritual when I'm alone. But it's in community that we are challenged to take seriously the reality of interdependence. Therefore, when we're building community, it's imperative that we bring our practice to it and really inhabit the qualities that we most value. It's hard work building community, and there are always a number of complex interests to be balanced. In addition, there are often complex power dynamics at work. There's always a power structure in any organization, coalition, or community, including our sanghas. Sometimes it's formal and obvious, and sometimes it's more informal and hidden, which can make it even more challenging. That is why I didn't find working in a feminist collective any easier than working in a paramilitary police department. Maybe it was easier in a paramilitary police department. So as Buddhists, we're often running around with very good intentions and trying very hard to be nice. And our very human desires to be seen for who we are and to have some influence in the communities that we're part of, they're not thought of as very spiritual things, and so they're often hidden and denied, even to ourselves. However, when individuals in organizations and communities do not deny their need for power and influence, but they learn to manage their assumptions and their fears around it, then a type of transformative trust can develop that is quite wonderful. And there are many different ways to build this kind of trust, but it usually begins with examining how decisions are made and who has access and does not have access to the decision-making process. So community builders, sangha builders, also understand the importance of honoring difference. Of course, this means recognizing that equality does not mean sameness. And this doesn't just apply to the usual categories that we think of and cannot change, such as race, gender, sexual orientation, and all the other categories that we can't change. But it also applies to our skills and assets. Community builders understand that our membership in majority and minority cultures, like everything else, is fluid, and it can change. It can change from location to location, organization to organization, and culture to culture. For example, now when I was working in the police department in the city of Madison, Wisconsin, my white skin certainly made me part of the majority culture. And my gender and sexual orientation made me part of the minority culture. But creative examination of the fluidity of our membership in majority and minority cultures can be used as an opportunity to more deeply understand how privilege and unconscious bias operates in every single one of our lives. And the wisdom that comes from that understanding is invaluable in building rich and harmonious communities. And this whole area can be such a struggle for Buddhists to wrap our head around, because it usually goes for us something like this. If we deeply understand interdependence and non-self and know we are all connected, what's the big deal? In the end, aren't we really all the same? Well, this is an example of a surface understanding without deep insight. The problem is that with privilege comes an invisible package of unearned assets that we can count on cashing in each and every day, but that we remain relatively unaware of. For example, I can count on walking around a department store without being followed by a security guard. I can count on presenting a credit card and seldom be asked for identification. I can feel confident that I'm not going to get pulled over by a police officer while driving unless I've actually committed a traffic infraction. And I probably won't get arrested for breaking into my own house. And there are other sets of unearned assets that I don't have access to because of my gender and my sexual orientation. And we'll be exploring all these things in more depth at a workshop this weekend that some of you are coming to. However, for me, and for now, let me just say that this may explain why there is the potential for members of the larger majority group to feel uneasy by the formation of minority subgroupings who may feel a need to maintain a sense of autonomy with each other while remaining active and equally involved in the larger group. A sense of mutual respect and understanding is developed with the recognition, really, that although there is no hierarchy of oppression, that each form is unique, and it may be necessary for people to explore their own unique histories with others who have had similar experiences. We all need to feel the safety that comes with knowing we are being heard, knowing we are being believed, understood, and validated. And often this can only happen with people who have had similar experiences. We can be valuable members of vibrant communities if our participation includes a willingness to take risks, a commitment to understanding each other, and to remain patient, flexible, knowledgeable about, and committed to group process, and that is very challenging. Sometimes the most valuable members of any group are the ones who quietly hold and create the container for the rest of us with their patience and the steadiness that their very presence creates. We will also be valuable members of communities if we are able to be honest about why we are in any group, what our needs are, and what skills we can and cannot contribute, then our energies are going to flow toward each other rather than against each other. Fifth, I've learned the importance of ethical courage, ethical communication, and right speech. In fact, I am convinced that right speech is probably the most important peace work that any of us engage in. Personally, I'm convinced that working with right speech alone could be my entire practice and my entire path to enlightenment. And ethical courage is something that requires remaining faithful to your values, developing the confidence to be willing to admit mistakes, and cultivating a very deep sense of humility. And I've found that this is especially important for those of us who have the authority of the state behind us. It's important to water the seeds of peace within ourselves and others, but not at the expense of injustice or the exploitation of others. Ethical courage and communication includes the willingness to be a voice for the disenfranchised. We need to ask ourselves in all the various settings that we're a part of, who will suffer if I don't speak up? But it's very difficult to have ethical courage if you don't know what you stand for. And ironically, many people haven't given a lot of thought to this. Remaining faithful to your values requires knowing what you commit yourself to, what you stand for, what you take refuge in, and what view of yourself that you want to manifest in the world. Inner integrity requires knowing these things so that what we do in the world and in our relationships with each other is in alignment with our deepest values. We are what we seek. And these important decisions are often made by default when we are living our lives on fast forward. So one way to simplify our lives isn't just by cleaning out our possessions, but by having a very, very clear intention of purpose, and then supporting that purpose with the way that we live and direct our mind. I ended my career in the police department as the captain of personnel and training. And that meant that I was in charge of not only all the hiring and firing and personnel functions, but the running of the Recruit Police Academy and all of the required in-service training for commissioned personnel. And the last exercise, what I did is I changed. We used to have this core curriculum of ethics, and I said, you know, ethics shouldn't be something that sits over here. It should be something that's taught in every single lesson plan. So we did. We found ways to incorporate ethics in every single thing that happened in our 9-month academy. But right before graduation, I put the recruits every year through this exercise where they were forced to uncover and state their core values. There were several different steps to it. They had to look at who they've been, because, you know, there's no better predictor for the future than the past. Is this really who you want to be? I'm not going to describe the whole exercise. It actually took quite a long, but I did quite a long time. And, you know, one of the best gifts I ever got from one of the classes that graduated was they had made a journal of everybody's core value statements and said, please remind us of these throughout our careers. And the reason I did this is because I knew that the pressure is especially strong to conform to peer pressure with respect to things that you don't necessarily personally or ethically support. And that pressure is strong in most workplaces, but it's especially strong in a culture where your safety is literally dependent on your peers. So there's tremendous peer pressure in almost every organization that I have worked or consulted in to conform to informal and often unspoken and sometimes unconscious agreements that are part of the organizational culture. So changing the ethical climate of an organization or community requires bringing those unspoken ways of operating and those unspoken agreements and unwritten codes of conduct into the conscious arena for open dialogue and examination in order to change the agreements. A collective example of that, Martin Luther King changed the agreements for civil rights in this country. Right now, I'm part of an organization that I just love called the Dane County Time Bank because it's changing the agreements about money, what money is. But much of the individual stress and dysfunction in organizations have to do with a lack of ethical communication. And right speech invites us to deeply understand the power that words create for ourselves and others, and to learn that every thought we have doesn't have to be repressed or expressed. That's a tough lesson. And we can learn this important practice of pausing and refraining just by putting space and learning to put space between our thoughts and our words. What I've found, actually, in just about every organization that I've been a part of, or in any organization that I see experiencing dysfunction, is that the lack of ethical communication is usually the biggest stressor for the individuals in those organizations. What would your workplace be like if people didn't gossip? You know, or if people didn't spend a lot of time behind closed doors with A talking to B about C? Or if people didn't spend a lot of time calling each other up on the phone and trying to recruit other people to their viewpoints? There are three elements of right speech that seem so simple and that are often assumed ground rules, especially in our sanghas and practice communities, but are in fact often lacking. A commitment to eliminating as much gossip as possible, a commitment to deep listening, and a commitment to preserving harmony in the community by resolving conflicts as they come up. And there are lots of different ways of doing this and lots of different tools for doing this. Ethical communication is challenging, and it doesn't happen by default. It requires consciously built ground rules that everybody takes responsibility for creating and maintaining. It sounds so simple, but it is an important and challenging process that often requires very skillful facilitation. Now, one of my friends decided to experiment with gossip. And just for 30 days, not gossip about anybody. And he discovered that 90% of his speech was eliminated. You know, that's kind of scary. And for those of you that have seen the movie Doubt, there's this incredible and compelling scene where the pillow is broken open and the parallels are made to gossip as the feathers floating into the air. Once they're gone, they're carried in ways that we can't control and we can never get them back. We can never pull them all back. But kindness is like that too. So there are other things that we can engage in that have the same effects. Sixth, I've learned compassion can be fierce as well as gentle. It was Ty who convinced me that it was possible to carry a gun mindfully, that to do so could be an act of love, and that being a peace officer requires the wisdom to know when to be the fierce bodhisattva and when to be the gentle bodhisattva. And with real understanding, compassion, and a tender heart, we can be both gentle and fierce enough to develop good boundaries and the wisdom to enable us to be firm and kind at the same time in our personal work and community relationships. While work was an obvious personal practice arena for me with respect to gentle and fierce compassion, the most challenging arena for me has been as a parent in my relationship with my youngest son. Fierce compassion in our personal relationships requires establishing boundaries that are not only necessary, but boundaries that we can keep. If we waffle on the boundaries, we destroy the integrity that they offer to protect and restore the relationship. That's why it's so important not to create boundaries that we don't feel totally committed to, that we don't feel good about, and that we're not sure we can uphold. And in this area, less is often more. These boundaries exist not just to ensure that our time and generosity won't be taken advantage of, but to protect our relationships with others. If we don't have good boundaries, our hearts begin to contract from either resentment or fear or anger, and then the possibilities for transforming the relationship now or in the future disappear. But when compassion turns into enabling behavior, Buddhists call it idiot compassion. Last, and maybe most important, an important part of Buddhist mindfulness practice is learning to water the seeds of joy. So often we're so serious about our practice that we forget this. Mindfulness practice in and of itself invites us to slow down enough to let the world tickle our hearts with the wonders of the present moment, to find the extraordinary in the ordinary and enjoy deeply our relationships with each other. Being present brings about a sense of contentment because we don't need to look for a better thought, a better emotion, or a better place to be. However, it is impossible to do this without consciously setting your life up to make sure that the things that matter the most are not at the mercy of the things that matter the least. And this is true both for the values we stand for and how we spend our time. Most of us embark on this path because we realize that it's a way to alleviate our suffering and wake up to our true nature by erasing our illusions of separateness. However, many of us are unable to slow down the frenzy of our lives to create enough time to make the possibility of waking up a reality. Thomas Merton said, "To allow ourselves to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone and everything is to succumb to violence. The frenzy of our activism neutralizes our work for peace. It destroys our own inner capacity for peace. It destroys the fruitfulness of our own work because it kills the root of inner wisdom which makes work fruitful." End of quote. It's an amazing quote. And my own teacher, Ty, continually reminds his students to develop a sense of urgency about their practice. He says, "There's no more God, there's no more Jesus, there's no more Allah, there's no more Buddha in the future than there is in this very moment." In other words, if not now, when? This is it. Likewise, he reminds us that practicing mindfulness isn't just about sitting on the cushion or developing a contemplative practice. An important part of the practice of mindfulness is consciously watering the seeds of joy. When I was a captain in the police department, I was so distressed to see not just police officers, but friends of mine who were still in their 30s and 40s developing the I used to syndrome. I used to camp, I used to hike, I used to bicycle, I used to garden, I used to knit, I used to play basketball, I used to enjoy leisurely time with friends and families. or whatever activities one has given up participating in because of a lack of time and too many demands. Participating in the activities that bring us joy are ways of taking back our lives because we enter into them with our whole heart. And they awaken, deepen, and sustain the contemplative experience in the present moment. These are our personal Zen activities because we fall into the complete absorption of the moment when participating in them. And they develop some of the same qualities that other mindfulness practices do. Focus, concentration, a deep sense of enjoyment and gratitude, and the ability to be completely in the present moment. I discovered my first Zen activity at about 5 years old. It was baseball. I played it whenever I could, and when I wasn't playing it until I was about 11 years old, this is kind of an embarrassing story. I had this little transistor radio, and you know, I lived just outside of Milwaukee, and then the Milwaukee Braves were in town, and they were good. We're talking 50s here, folks. I'd put my little radio up, and I'd pick one player to be. Now, it could be Hank Aaron, it could have been Eddie Matthews, Red Shandies, Johnny Logan. I'd change it up. And when that player was sitting on the bench, I'd sit on the bench. And when he went to the on-deck circle, I'd go to the on-deck circle. And when he went up to bat, I'd go up to bat. When he took the field, I'd take the field. And if I was going to be a pitcher that day, I would beg my dad for just a couple pennies so I could run down to the store and get my chow, you know, and chew the bubble gum. And so, you know, as the years went on, I started playing very competitive semi-pro fast pitch, and then when I got too old to do that, I coached my kids' teams and other teams, and now I just love being a spectator, and I am a fantasy baseball player. You know, after all, what better Buddhist activity is there to enjoy? The sport is timeless. It's one of the only sports in which there's no clock and the goal is to come home. There you have it. But our Zen activities can be sports, gardening, cooking, being in nature, any activity that resonates for us personally and nurtures a deep sense of space, joy, and gratitude in us. If we're faithful to the practice of the things that bring us joy, our practice will be faithful to us. And when we participate in the things that we enjoy deeply, we participate in our own enlightenment. Ironically, in order to do this, it requires some proactive time management. So I'm going to share my secret with you. About this time every year, I buy my 2010 calendar. And what I do is I put everything in it that I want to do. And then I let all the other demands that are constantly on me and come up be scheduled around those things. You know, for the first 53 of my 56 years, I spent doing it the other way, and they never happened. They just never happened. So that's the most important trick for myself that I've discovered to make sure that the things that matter the most aren't at the mercy of the things that matter the least. So in conclusion, let me just say that as my own practice has progressed, I've begun to understand that working for peace and justice and building community is simply a journey of gentle honesty. And I'm confident only in the fact that I have made and will continue to make lots of mistakes in all of the things I've talked to you about tonight. And this is just a part of the practice. It's not about perfection. So as I continue to learn how to make friends with my own humanity, what I've experienced is a deeper understanding of the spiritual realities of humility, gratitude, patience, and forgiveness. And somewhere along the line, I stopped making my spiritual practice a self-improvement project. You know, and I began to experience the grace that comes with letting go of achievement and project mentality, the grace that comes with crumbling walls of guilt And the grace that comes with focusing on how far I've come rather than focusing on how far I have to go. There's literally been research on Olympic elite athletes with similar skills. And the research has been done to try to figure out why some of these athletes perform very well in competition and some of them don't perform so well. And what they found out is those that perform well are always noticing how far they've come. And those that become head cases are the ones that are always looking to the horizon and are always focused on how far they have to go. It's called the horizon effect. And it's a reminder to really appreciate how far we've come. For me, the greatest gifts of my practice have come with an understanding of how to ride the waves of my own life with faith in my Buddha nature and the confidence that I'm the ocean and not the temporary waves. And in the most challenging arena of my own practice, my best teacher, my relationship with my youngest son, I'm committed to continuing to allow my heart to be torn open in love rather than protected in fear. And some days I do better than others. And it's simply okay. So I send metta to each and every one of you. I wish you the best in your own spiritual journeys. I'm grateful for your practice and your presence, for all you bring to this moment and the communities that you are each part of building. And I thank you for the opportunity to share some of these reflections with you tonight. Let's sit just for a moment. May the merit of our practice tonight be dedicated to all beings. May all beings be safe and protected. May all beings be mindful and peaceful. And may all beings be filled with great ease, love, and compassion. Thank you.